Pratimoksha, as I began the first day, is very much for a person who's very honest with one's own capabilities and a very realistic approach, and depends very much on external causes and conditions to being conducive to generating or bringing about mindfulness in one's own mind. So it is definitely always referred to as a person of lesser potential, not in a critical way, but being very realistic of who we are. Mahayana approach is cultivated by a person who is a slightly more optimistic about one's mindfulness, more brave. It is called the middling capacity, and it is a potential that all human beings have, and therefore responding to that potential by being courageous. The term is courage over here. To being courageous, to actually respond to a potential, is said to be the undertaking of the bodhisattva vows. However, a person of very high caliber, high potential, is also a person who is said to be a suitable vessel within which the tantra vows can arise. To understand Vajrayana, what is called tantra, mantra, Vajrayana, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, everything is one. They're all the same. There are different synonyms referring to the same. Tantrayana, if you try to understand it from a conceptual mind, with history, with structures, with divisions and categories, we, of course, through history, attempts have been made into doing that. But it's still going to be very difficult. Why do a lot of people have difficulty in understanding Vajrayana principle? Is because they try to understand Vajrayana from a very conceptual perspective. Vajrayana is approached by a person who has hopefully done a lot of Mahayana training and understanding, particularly worked with the Prajnaparamita teachings. Now, in the Bodhisattva vow, we did talk about a person who may have understood the relationship between mind and phenomena. Let's take a bodhisattva, for example, who's worked in one's own meditation and built an insight that has a clearer understanding of what is the nature of phenomena, what are the nature of the displays, what is the nature, to be more simple, what is the nature of this world that we call the world? Is it really only what my mind thinks it to be? For example, a lot of us sometimes struggle with the concept of hell realm beings. Many of us struggle with the concept of Buddha fields. So in Tibetan Buddhist Vajrayana tradition, we talk about Sangdopalri, for example, the copper-colored mountain. We talk about Akanishta, the heavens of... I'll use the term heavens, also, although it's not the right word, but just to sort of exercise the mind a little bit here. The heavens of Samantabhadra. The Buddha fields of, let's say, Amitabha as Sukhavati, and so forth. So mind sometimes thinks, is it really a Buddha field? Is there another dimension? And of course, various kinds of approaches and explanations are given to it. Some people struggle with it to a degree where they think this is something beyond what you can grasp, and therefore you tend more towards not believing in it. I remember coming to the West the first time with Paturubuchi's 18 hell realms, and then people saying, are there really the 18 hell realms? I don't believe. It can be hell realms in this world, but it cannot be a different realm of existence, because where is it? I don't see it. Whereas Paturubuchi in the same teaching says, well, if you believe in this, you'll have to believe in a lot of other things. That you think it is impossible because you can't see it is being very arrogant. It's an arrogant statement that says, things can only exist that what my senses are able to contain. That is an arrogant statement. So if you look at it from that perspective, you have to say how what New York is, for example. Back home, I know many people who have no concept. For them, it's easier to think that there is a hell realm, isn't it? Than to try and believe what exactly is happening around this area, for example. So it's about mind. What we're talking about is what we call real is often contained in a very linear outlook of what our senses are able to experience. Thoughts we think, and therefore we believe in them. Forms we think, and therefore we believe in them. sounds that we are familiar with, we believe in them. For example, if I said to you, what do you think? I said. Now if I translate that and say, you're all very good. Now it's a concept to you. So that's how sound is. What we are able to articulate, what we know, can immediately be conceptualized. What we don't know is not in our concept, but doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Tantra Buddhism allows you to look at Tantra in that perspective, and therefore it does talk about a lot of fantastic things, and they are fantastic. Whether hell runs, whether Buddha feels, whether deities with a thousand arms, whether mantras, all the techniques and the methods that are used are extraordinarily brilliant and at the same time astoundingly fantastic, in that they do sound very unreal and very much impossible. But it allows very skillfully for the mind to begin to sort of appreciate what the Mahayana may sometimes not even be able to convey, although it's not the fault of the teachings, but it is how we have looked to the teachings. When we think appearances are empty, what do we mean by that? Those appearances that I can see are empty, or all appearances are empty? What do we mean by sounds? Only those sounds that I can conceive of? Or are they actually sounds that must be allowed to be so diverse, so extraordinarily limitless and diverse in its manifestations that maybe my mind doesn't even have a concept of it? Therefore, from the same perspective, Buddhism, or if you take the origin of Buddhism, from the Tantra's perspective, doesn't begin just with the physical Buddha. So of course, Vajrayana Buddhism says, since we live in a very relative world, 2,500 years ago, there was an excellent enlightened being who turned the wheel of the Dharma, and therefore we see him as Shakyamuni Buddha. But then you'd have to say, is the Shakyamuni Buddha any different from any relative appearance? What is the reality of the Buddha, even Shakyamuni? Can Shakyamuni Buddha be eliminated as being more real than a tree? Another relative phenomena. You know, for example, we say in Buddhism, we love to take, you know, things as example. Mahayana teaching says the lid of this, rice holder is emptiness in nature because it is a compositeness of many different elements that come together. So the ultimate nature of this lid is said to be empty in that there is no single entity called lid existent other than it being a coming together of many different things which we have temporarily designated as being a lid. But then we come to the Buddha, and then the Buddha say, no, but that was very real. Lid we can see as empty. Buddha, if we can't see as empty, then where is the mind able to actually understand relationship between mind and phenomena, mind and appearance? Therefore, history of Tantra approaches slightly different from what is commonly called empirical history. A lot of the Hinayanists, a lot of Mahayanists also often have difficulty in trying to understand this, and they think it is being very disrespectful. But it is not disrespectful. It's encouraging the mind to embody what the Mahayana teachings of Prajnaparamita and emptiness has been saying altogether. Is that ultimately, if everything is a projection of your own mind, then within that mind also is the projection of the Buddha. Buddha didn't originate anywhere other than within the framework of your mind's projection. You exist, therefore the Buddha exists. And the Buddha's manifestation, his qualities, are expressed within the realm of your own projections. And in that projection, it can be as brilliant as pure, and in some projections of the mind, that Buddha doesn't even exist. So therefore, when we talk about Buddha in the Tantra Buddhism, we talk about it as primordial Buddha nature. one doesn't refer so much, although the veneration for Shakyamuni Buddha is, if not more, than the same as the Hinayana and the Mahayana teachings. There's no difference. But it encourages you to not distinguish it to such a degree that you begin to have a spiritual concept even related to the Buddha. And therefore, it says the Buddha, the brilliant nature of the Buddha itself, is your own primordial nature. So the origin of Buddha is then seen as your pristine, pure nature of mind. So in the ascertaining the three vows, the Tantra section begins where both Lochen Dhammachari and Ngari Panchen, both of them say, the history of Tantra arises from five, the essential history arises from five factors. And so here the five factors are seen as perfect teacher, perfect place, perfect assembly, perfect dharma or teachings, and the perfect time. For example, when we talk about how did Hinayana or the Pratimoksha originate, I went through a whole lot of history. When we talked about Bodhisattva, I went through a lot of history. Nagarjuna, Asanga, and Buddha, and Upali, and Kashyap, and Manjushri, and so on and so forth. Now, when we come to Tantra, we talk about Tantra began with these five situations. There has to be a teacher, there has to be a place, there has to be a time, there has to be a teaching, and there has to be a retinue who receive the teachings. But in the case of Tantra, the perfect teacher is said to be the perfect, primordially enlightened mind, your own. The very intrinsic, pure nature, untainted by any delusion, is the very Buddha from where the Tantra originated. Perfect place is said to be the place called self-awareness. Wherever there is the awareness, there is the Buddha always. Or does your Buddha have to be someone who has a geographical location called Bodh Gaya in India? If it's important to you and without it, you won't make any move to becoming a better person, then yes, there is a Buddha 2,500 years ago, went through abandoning the kingdom and became the enlightened and so on and so forth. There's a whole history. For some people, that's very important. But on the other hand, for a Tantrayana practitioner, one must realize that while that is referential and useful, on the other hand, true Buddha, from where even Buddha himself originated, is in realizing that the self, within the place of self-awareness, there is the Buddha that manifests. The perfect assembly is said to be the mandala of one's own projection. We talk about, let's say in Rajgir, where there were tens of thousands of bodhisattvas and arahats who received the teaching, the primary of whom were Manjushri and Maitreya and Vajrapani and so forth. We talk about that. But in Tantra, we say the perfect assembly is one's the mandala of one's own mind, one's own mind's projection. In your own mind's projection, you may have Manjushri, you can have Vajrapani, you can have Maitreya, you can have hundreds of others. You can have Jesus Christ, you can have Muhammad, you can have Indra and Brahma, you can have Buddhist and non-Buddhist, you can have yourself and your parents and, you know, everybody else. It's up to you. Or you can be very exclusive and only you being the assembly also. Every universe is as big as you make it, and it can be as small as you want it. Perfect Dharma is said to be the true nature as it is realized. There is no Dharma beyond that. Yes, we do talk about 84,000s. We talk about commentaries. We talk about the various kinds of great scholars having written, translated in Sanskrit, in Pali, in Tibetan, in English, and so on and so forth. Are they Dharma? Yes, they are Dharma. But all of them can be gathered into the single, and that's the true nature as it is. If you get it, you don't have to approach 84,000s. If you don't get it, all 84,000s become very necessary. Choice is always yours, and Tantra always puts it back into you. It's a way of challenging you to then saying, good, so you then claim to be a Tantra practitioner, someone who has now claimed. So whenever you go to a Vajrayana teaching, there's a person who says, yes, I know emptiness a little bit isn't it? So if you know emptiness nature a little bit, if you have been a good Patimoksha practitioner a little bit, if you've been able to practice Mahayana a little bit, then that little bit also makes you know that the ultimate true nature doesn't rest outside, it is internal of one's own self. So the perfect teaching is the self or the spontaneous expressivity of the absolute true nature of things as they truly are. That realization is the perfect Dhamma. Perfect time, the fifth factor, is then said to be the expanse within which this realization permeates. And therefore, whenever the realization of the true nature as it is arises, within that mind that holds the framework, or that is the framework within which all of the true nature simply abides, in that self-awareness, within that true pure expanse, is then said to be the intrinsic primordially enlightened mind. That primordially enlightened mind has no history, has no origin, is not of the past, is not of the future, but is in this very moment. Within that moment, if the awareness is there, then one is becoming a suitable vessel within which the tantras or the tantra vow can be given. However, now, many of us don't have that capacity. We would love to have that capacity of realizing the intrinsic Buddha nature. But at the same time, our mind still struggles, no matter how far it has approached in trying to understand the truth of emptiness. It still will have difficulties in being able to reconcile between fundamental nature of emptiness and the expressivity of appearance. Because of this, where the great masters have known that the intelligent mind sees a certain theory but is unable to really articulate that as an irreversible confidence of shunyata. Since that difficulty is there, the methods of the Vajrayana called Tantrayana Buddhism have been given, which deals with mainly three things that matter to us and that are the impediments of not being able to rest the mind in the perfection of samadhi, of emptiness and appearance. And that then is by the method of what is called appearances, sound, and awarenesses. To transcend and experientially gain the realization of transcending appearance into emptiness, all the Tantrayana methods of visualization of various forms have been given. To transcend speech into its nature of emptiness, the methods of mantras have been given. And to transcend ordinary thoughts into pristine awareness, untainted by any dualistic tendencies, samadhi, Vajra Samadhi, as it is called, has been given. So we see Vajrayana Buddhism originate. It originates through many different traditions. In the ascertaining the three vows, the Indian historical origination of Tantra is also very in detail given. The Tantra originated in Sri Lanka as well as in Odiana, and then in India as well as in Tibet are also given. The hidden treasure teachings and how to regard them as Tantra teachings have all been given. And in detail, the origination of what are called outer Tantras, Kriya, Karya, and Yoga Tantra, and then the inner tantras of Maha, Anu, and Ati are very much in detail given. So I don't want to go into that at this moment. It's just hopeless even trying to attempt it. And so nevertheless, what is sort of the combined, what one can condense all of these teachings into is what you today know as Vajrayana Buddhism. To some, it's an object of great devotion and veneration that you practice very well. For many, it is always a subject of confusion and sometimes a lot of questions. And so the creation of many deities, visualization of many deities, recitation of many mantras, rituals of many kinds, practices of many kinds, some of the very practices which are called esoteric practices. All of these practices of visualization, mantra, and samadhi are all oriented towards this what we just talked about. Being able to have a confidence of seeing every appearance truly as your mind's own projection, seeing mind as being primordially enlightened. Saying your mind is primordially enlightened is slightly different from having an irreversible confidence in it. Wherever the irreversible confidence of one's own intrinsic nature being already perfect is less, if it is tainted with hesitation, appearances immediately will gain dominance over awareness. Sound will always gain dominance over awareness, and therefore one is again brought back into the impulses of the habitual tendencies. But how to get the confidence? How can we actually experientially see that right from the minutest of the particles to the greatest of the universe are the projections of your own mind, is then brought about through the various methods that are there in Vajrayana, in Tantra Buddhism, primarily with visualization, with mantra recitation, and the many different profound ways of meditating, which then began to be the basis from where Mahamudra and Dzogchen teachings came about, which incorporates form meditation and formless meditation. But in some ways, it is a way, as Tibetans usually say, just as a tanner tans leather by really sort of processing it, by rubbing it. We call, you rub the leather to such a degree that it becomes so supple and soft, and the more you rub it, the more softer and flexible it becomes. Vajrayana does that. It exercises the mind to project, to retract, to project, to retract, to make it, to retract, until you begin to get the point. Yes, indeed. Everything is entirely dependent upon the mind's projection. Good is mind, bad is mind. Beauty is mind, ugliness is mind. Purity is mind, impurity is mind. Virtue is mind, unvirtuous is mind. Killing is mind, not killing is also mind. Being right is mind, being wrong is also mind. Justice is also mind, injustice is also mind. So the Tantra challenges you to have what is called one taste. And that's the fundamental vow of Tantra, is that if you are a Vajrayana meditator, one must generate the confidence of having a single taste approach to everything. And so we do our recitations and we visualize and we generate the deity and we dissolve the deity. And we think, yes, just as the deity arises from my mind, dissolves into my mind, this universe arises from my mind, it dissolves into my mind. There's really nothing to get attached to. There's nothing to be afraid of. And then someone takes, you get up to get a coffee, cup of coffee. You come back and you find that your bell is missing. And then immediately we begin to say, where's my bell? Isn't it? That kind of an example is where we struggle with. Right now, what we're understanding Tantra is with a very conceptual mind. We have a faint idea of what it means when we talk about the non-duality or the inseparability of mind and emptiness. But the relativity is still very strong in us, isn't it? Since the relativity is so strong, you know the nature of bell is emptiness and the sound that the bell makes is emptiness, but it is still your bell. Since the relativity and the concept of relativity and the duality is so strong, you still need a teacher. You still need a practice. You still need vows. You still have to practice and approach Tantra with commitments, with things to cultivate, and with things to abandon. Ultimately, to say Tantra has vows is almost contradictory to what it believes in, to what it is. Nevertheless, a Tantra taught to a person, taught to an ordinary human being, whose mind still requires tremendous references to even understand what basic goodness is, then Tantra is also explained in a very sort of a technical form and a relative way. It's a wonderful text. Of course, it doesn't require me to speak about it, but I believe that the vows, just as all the teachings, but the explanation of the vows must be studied and understood by meditators, because Western Buddhism especially is at a time today where it has to break free from the romantic idea of what it is. So if one sees Buddhism only as a, you know, with the sort of what we call starry-eyed romantic idea, then for some, of course, that is still a period that you can enjoy. But for most of you who have been practicing, it is very important that you become serious about the path of practice that you are engaging in, because it is a tremendously profound and a true path that has the capacity to really bringing about the best potential of a human being. That is your capacity, that is your capability. And finding it is itself very difficult, and having found it, and having met with the Dharma, and having all the favorable conditions, which are far more powerful than the non-conducive conditions, then it is very important that you do not waste your life, but study and practice the Dharma sincerely, ensuring one of the very important aspects and precepts of Mahayana Buddhism is not to fabricate and distort the Dharma, to make its state sort of more pleasurable for your senses, not practice the Dharma that you would like Dharma to be, but you should become what the Dharma actually encourages you to become. So it's very important that you rise from your very sort of state of misconceptions to this pure state, and not bring that pure Dharma to be more suitable and convenient to whatever state that we are in at this time.